So we're changing the order, I think in the program it has Dr. Schmidt talking about nutrition in this slot, but she and I are switching, and I'll be presenting some general information on the charge study that will apply for her study in as well. So this is about insecticides, an overview and some new results. We know that these compounds are actually designed for the purpose of destroying or killing lower species. That's the purpose of a pesticide, as opposed to many of the other chemicals that are out that happen to be byproducts of the modern environment. The CNS of the insect actually includes a brain, and many of these compounds function through disruption of ion channels, sodium chloride, calcium channels. They also, some of them are endocrine disruptors, and they interfere with either thyroid homeostasis or various kinds of sex steroids, including androgens, androgen bindings, estrogens, and there are mimics of anti-estrogens and estrogen mimics and so forth. So these compounds have really, and they also affect immune systems and a variety of other systems. They are, in fact, can be poisonous when taken in large doses in mammals. So three major classes of compounds have been used as insecticides over really a long period, many decades. In the 1930s, the organochlorine pesticides were developed and became widespread. They bioaccumulate up the food chain, which was not known at the time they were introduced. They have a high affinity for lipids, and they're very, very persistent. They were banned with something called the Stockholm Convention in the 1970s, which was very concerned about the persistence of some toxic chemicals in the environment. But these are, and they're used primarily for malaria control, and they actually are still used in many countries of the world where malaria is endemic. They are apparently the most effective compounds out there for killing the Anopheles mosquitoes. And that, so that's where those compounds are. And some of them are still used in certain products, so they're sold in countries that don't have a malaria problem. So in response to the toxicity and persistence of these compounds, the industry went to work at designing less persistent compounds, and they came up with the organophosphates. These have actually quite short half-lives, but they also have a lot of types of toxicity. And as a result, really, of a number of children's studies that were done in the 1990s, in 2001, there was a cancellation of the registration of these compounds for residential use in the United States. I'm actually not quite sure what the situation is in Europe and other parts of the world. I imagine they're still widely used in some places. They have been replaced by a group of compounds that started to be developed back in the 1980s, known as the pyrethroids, which are modeled after a natural pesticide called pyrethrin, which occurs in the chrysanthemum plant. And the synthetic versions have been designed to be a little bit more toxic and to degrade less rapidly in sunlight, because they do photodegradation is the process in the environment. But the exposures are actually quite widespread. Some data from the United States suggests that 99% of people have detectable levels 99% of homes have detectable levels in floor wipes, and definitely over 75%, even using data before the banning of the organophosphates, have blood levels, detectable blood levels. But there's actually been few studies in humans as compared to the organochlorines and the organophosphates. So we have this trend where we take one set of compounds and we replace them with another one that has different properties, and there isn't apparently adequate testing to foresee some of the health problems that may emerge. How does exposure occur? Nowadays, it's mostly residues in food such as dairy, meat, and fish, also fruits and vegetables. household applications indoors or around the garden, on pets, and for head lice. Lindane is an organochlorine used for that purpose. And then there's drift from agricultural and structural applications and other commercial uses. But in general, there are still residues of organochlorines. There are still organophosphates detectable in many people, even after the ban, and pyrethroids as well. And there are a few other classes. Now, the organophosphates have been studied for neurodevelopment, actually, quite a few studies in the recent decade. Cognitive impairment in several different studies, a couple of them in New York, finding deficits in perceptual reasoning and in interaction with the PON1 genotype, which is responsible for metabolism of the peroxynase enzyme, is responsible for metabolism of OPs, several of them. And then working memory and IQ in another study. And then also attention problems have been studied in at least two investigations using children. And in some cases, in the Rao study, they measured the chlorpyrifos in the umbilical cord blood, so an objective prospective measure prior to birth. And similarly, in another study looking at maternal pregnancy metabolites in the urine. Now, the study by Ginny Rao in New York actually had a sub-study that was recently published, which I think is very germane to the field of autism. And that is, they took 20 children who had high chlorpyrifos levels, that's one of the organophosphates, and 20 with low levels, and none of them had much in the way of environmental tobacco smoke, and they were all in the lowest category of PAH exposures based on some other work from that group. The results show that the higher levels of these of the chlorpyrifos in in umbilical cord blood was associated with enlargement of a set of areas in the brain using neuroimaging data, superior temporal, posterior middle temporal, and inferior postcentral gyri, and that was bilateral, and then several other areas where it was primarily in the right hemisphere. And here are some of the figures from that paper. And you can see the top shows the bilateral areas that were that lit up in these MRIs, and then the bottom row shows the ones that were primarily on the right side and not on the left hemisphere. The interpretation of these findings is that, according to the authors, really the origin is in the underlying white matter. And interestingly, these enlargements actually correspond to regions for attention and receptive language processing, as well as social cognition and emotional control and inhibition. And they're also consistent with several animal studies that have looked at early prenatal chlorpyrifos exposure and have shown that there is cytotoxicity to the glia and neurons and real signs of damage of neurons in the form of glial scarring. So now I'm going to present a couple of slides showing the data, three studies that have looked at either ASD or pervasive developmental disorders in relation to insecticides. And the first one here was by Eric Roberts. It was done looking at data from California, taking the California Department of Developmental Services, which provides services for persons with developmental disabilities throughout the state. And it's not quite as complete as a registry, but it absolutely has the overwhelming majority of persons who are diagnosed with an ASD. And they mapped the birth addresses on the birth certificate files and linked them to the set of applications of commercial pesticides which are reportable to the state of California in the form of a pesticide use report. And they looked at pounds applied within preset buffers of distance from the residences of the cases as well as the controls. And the controls were taken from the birth certificate files. And what they found was that ASD was associated with actually three different classes, the organochlorines, the organophosphates, and the bifenthrin, which is the most persistent of the pyrethroids. They focused in the article, you'll only read really primarily about the OCs, but these other two findings, the other two findings are actually in the tables and were, in fact, significant. So important to take note of. The next study was also done in California. It's a cohort study of primarily Mexican-American families in the California Central Valley. Study is known as the Chamaco study. And they measured dialkyl phosphate metabolites of the organophosphate pesticides in the maternal pregnancy urine and found that higher DAP concentrations were associated with the number of symptoms of pervasive developmental delay on a subscale in the aberrant behavior checklist. And then a similar analysis was done in that study from New York where I showed the brain imaging results where they also found, in this case, umbilical cord chlorpyrifos level was also associated with the number of PBD symptoms on that scale. So three studies suggestive of some kind of relationship between organophosphates and autism. So now I'm going to turn to the CHARGE study, which stands for Childhood Autism Risks from Genes in the Environment, been conducted out of the Mind Institute at UC Davis, located here in the middle of the northern part of the California Central Valley. And our goal from the beginning has been to identify causes and contributing factors to autism, including environmental, genetic, and the interactions of the two. We're also interested in characterizing phenotypic subsets that might be etiologically related, although I won't be presenting any data on that aspect of the study. So when we started out, this is the first list of suspect compounds that we came up with, and you can see pesticides was at the top of the list for reasons I've already talked about it, why it's designed. And then these are the many ways in which we collect information about such exposures, including biospecimens, which some of which are, post facto after the actual diagnosis, like the blood sample, unless you're looking at something that's very, very persistent. But we do have ability to look at some of the earlier exposures through collection of the newborn blood spots that the state collects, for example. And then we have many interviews, and we can link to exposure databases such as the one that Mark spoke about, as well as medical records, which, again, are collected prospectively and don't rely on recall from mothers. And then there's a few posters listed down here that are coming out of the CHARGE study at this meeting and another oral session. The method is case control sampling with population-based recruitment, standardized confirmation of the diagnoses, and although I won't be showing any lab data, we are linked to a number of molecular biology, genetics, and immunology laboratories. The three groups involve two case groups, both taken from the California DDS, children with autism and children with developmental delay but no autistic symptoms, and then a control group that is drawn from the general population by matching from the birth files to the age, gender, and geographical distribution of the autism cases. So the sampling frames, then, are this California DDS database of persons receiving services for these conditions and then the California birth files. But, in fact, we also link these two case groups to their birth records and including the ones that aren't in the study. So what we actually have is a nested case control study where we have a lot of information about the pool that we sampled from. We have all of the sociodemographic data, and we can actually determine to what degree we have a selection bias both in our cases and in our controls. So it actually goes a step further than just saying, oh, well, there could be selection bias. We know that people participate in studies who are more educated in general, and maybe cases are more motivated to participate. We actually can measure the degree to which that is happening and how it relates to these sociodemographic factors. And then we're able to correct for that differential participation using methods that are commonly employed in national surveys, such as those done by the U.S. National Center for Health Statistics, like NHANES and others, by fitting a participation model, developing weights, and then applying those in our substantive analyses. So then all three groups to be eligible have to be within our age group, 24 to 60 months, born in California, living with a biological parent who speaks either English or Espanol, and who reside in our study catchment area, which is essentially about an hour and a half drive to the Mind Institute. The clinic visit involves administration of the ADOS and the ADIR, both by trained, reliable clinicians, and a medical exam, medical history, broad assessment of other behavioral domains, cognitive and adaptive function, and comorbidities. And then we screen for ASD among both of the non-ASD groups, and those who score high on the SCQ above 12, we then administer the full ADIR and ADOS and place them in their appropriate diagnostic category. The interview that we then conduct collects a wide array of information. I'm just mentioning a few of them here, lifestyle, demographics, and so forth. And we collect, starting preconceptionally, we actually go up until the current time period, but what I'm going to show today is data from what I'll call this index period, 3 months before conception out to 2 years. And now I'm going to report on a little bit from three analyses of insecticides that we conducted. The first one was to determine whether children who were born in households located near commercial applications of agricultural insecticides were more likely to have a confirmed diagnosis. So we're using the database that Eric Roberts used that is kept by the state on pesticide applications. And this figure shows in the middle, the little blue dot would be a home. And then you see a 1,500-meter radius circle. That would be, say, one of the buffer sizes we might have that we used. And then the grid that this is overlaid on is these are 1 square mile squares, which is about 1.6 kilometers squared. And this is how the pesticide use applications are reported by these units. They're part of the U.S. Geological Survey that created this across the whole United States. And then the centroids of each of those squares are what we compare to the buffer to determine which exposures do we think the woman is likely to have been exposed to during her pregnancy. And this work actually, some of it was presented in a poster last year by Dr. Janie Shelton. And basically she saw three categories: carbamates, which are in fact related to the organophosphates and pyrethroids in different time intervals related to autism, an autism diagnosis. And again, this, even though it's a case-control study, these are objective measures of exposure. The second insecticide analysis was to determine whether household use of products was associated with higher risk for confirmed autism diagnosis. And these are some of the questions we asked. Did you or someone in your household use ants, fly, cockroach control products, or pet flea or tick shampoos, or skin applications on the pet, indoor foggers, or professional pest control services? And again, this should say out to 2 years, the time period. So the little pictures on the right, you have Raid as a spray, you have a fogger, and then you have a child shampooing the dog in a little can there. And then the last one in the bottom is these little drops that you put on the back of the neck of the pet to kill fleas. This is a crude table showing the percent who used the sprays or foggers, the flea products, and the bait by their diagnostic status, and I'm leaving out the developmental delay group for now. This is ASD. You can see that in general they seem to have used the sprays more than the typically developing parents did. higher proportion did. And similarly, not quite as much of a difference for the flea products, and really no difference whatsoever with the baits. These are the odds ratios that have been adjusted now for confounders, including the sociodemographic factors, as well as the matching factors of age, gender, and geographic region. And those are actually quite broad geographic regions. These analyses seem to show that the sprays and foggers may be related to, or at least there's an observed association here. Whether it's causal or not is another question. But these seem to show associations for the 3 months before pregnancy, and each of the two first years of life. The analysis is also stratified. It's not exactly stratified. It's looking at two different time periods. The first one is 1998 to 2008. It's approximately the time of conception of these pregnancies. And it's most of the pregnancies in the CHARGE study, almost all of them, in fact. The 2002 to 2008, which are shown in blue, start with 2002, and that's to look at the time period after the chlorpyrifos was banned to see whether that made any difference. And there's a slightly higher, but not much, odds ratio when we restrict to that time period. But again, the flea products, all of those confidence intervals easily overlap with the null values. And then the third analysis was to determine whether household use of specific chemicals in insecticides is associated with a higher risk. Now, this is a chart that is based on these databases that tell you what are the active ingredients in a given product. And these are not mutually exclusive categories. We're just looking at different ways to categorize exposures. You can see that there's a change. The organophosphates in the 97 to 2008 period represented 16.5% of the reported products that we had in our database from the participants and matched up with these existing databases on products. Whereas that went down to 0.8% in the 2002 to 2008 period. Most of the others, there's not big changes over time, but you can see that there's a variety of kinds of products that are out there, and the different types of these products have different kinds of active ingredients in them. So we did a linkage then, and what we the analysis that we then took was to say, if a woman used a product that shows up as 71% of the time from the information she gave us that would have had a pyrethroid, then we gave her this probability of 71%. And we actually did a set of multiple imputations, 100 imputations, and each time she had a 71% chance that she got pyrethroids and a 29% chance that it was not. And to take into account the variability and the uncertainty based on self-reported products and what's actually in them. And so this is the analysis, and it's multivariate adjusted, but it also has this imputation incorporated into both the point estimates and the standard errors. And the results are somewhat similar to the sprays and foggers, although maybe slightly attenuated relative to the other analysis. Looking at pyrethrins without the pyrethroids, if they use products that only contain pyrethrins, there were fewer of these, so you see wider confidence intervals, but they really hover pretty close to the null value, and the same thing for the other pesticides. And then this is the last analysis I'll show you. This is actually based on another insecticide called imidacloprid, and we did a Bayesian analysis to try to account for misclassification using the self-reports and a series of different assumptions. And I won't go through the whole thing except to say that each of those big stripes there, the 1, 2, 3, and 4, represented different types of assumptions. For example, the top one suggests the assumptions in each of those simulations has a higher sensitivity in the typically developing than in the ASD group. I think it's panel 2 that has equal sensitivity and equal specificity in both the cases, in the cases compared with the controls, and then varying other versions of that. So there are some sets of assumptions that would lead to an elevated risk for imidacloprid and others that do not. And several other papers are actually in review. The limitations of these analyses are, of course, maternal reports and the potential for differential recall with mothers who are more concerned either remembering possibly more accurately or possibly less accurately. There is also the issue in the analysis looking at the pesticide use report, those objective measures. There is the problem of measurement error and, you know, the effects of drift and wind direction and that sort of thing. The outcomes, on the other hand, I think are a strength in this study because they were all confirmed by clinicians who have reliability. The study sample is actually quite diverse. I didn't show you those data, but we have a high proportion, about a third of the sample are Hispanics, and then we have African-Americans and mixed-race individuals representing another 10 to 15%. So it's quite diverse. Pretty representative, actually, in some ways, of California. And our sampling strategy, as I mentioned earlier, allowed us to calculate some generalizable odds ratios to the population that we're selecting samples from and also wanting to extrapolate to. Some of our further analyses being planned, trimester-specific analyses, dose response for regular versus occasional users, gene by environment interaction. We have some data back from a CNV hotspot array and gene expression data, also RNA-seq data conducted by Synaptics, and then comparisons with the developmental delay population. To summarize kind of the broader picture here, not just these studies, there have been, therefore, several studies that have found insecticides or insecticide products associated with either ASD or PDD symptoms. Some of these have been prospective, some have been case control. The exposure information sources are varied, but many of them did use objectively collected databases or biological measurements taken at appropriate time points, but others relied on self-report. The literature does suggest that two of the common comorbidities, cognitive and attention deficits, also show associations with the OPs. And the brain imaging data, I think, is really intriguing in relation to the OPs that I think provides some support for the looking down into the black box of mechanisms and effects on the brain directly. And then I just want to acknowledge the many, many collaborators who've worked with us on the CHARGE study from many institutions, many staff, of course, and the many, many families who have participated, and then the funders. Thank you very much.